The Last Word with Matt Cooper.
We'll be talking about that actor's career as part of the week trending, given that Roe McDermott, who of course does our movies regularly for us, is with us. With Lorcan Nine, the head of training in the communications clinic, we're also going to be talking about getting rid of car parks at third level institutions and the phenomenon of Sally Rooney, whose new novel was released this week. But I want to start with you, Lorcan, by what has been another extraordinary, terrifying week as for what's happening in the Middle East. Because after last week's pager bombs by Israel against Hezbollah, we've had essentially a missile strike after missile strike, not an invasion of ground troops, but essentially war been waged against Lebanon by Israel, even though I think they're trying to claim at the United Nations that it's not war. It's in a sort of an Orwellian way been called a preemptive strike against the likelihood of Hezbollah doing something to Israel. So it's not war. Surely it's war by any other word.
Yeah, and I think that there's been a huge amount of wars who have been kind of justified with those preemptive strikes. I think ancient Rome never went into a war without saying that it was a preemptive strike and it was really defence as they built their entire empire. But yeah, look, there's strikes on Beirut as we speak. You know, as we're coming in here, I mean, there's continuing strikes on downtown Beirut. I think it's the fifth time this week.
I think a claim that the Hezbollah headquarters has now been destroyed. And I suppose Israel supporters would say that Hezbollah, just like Hamas did in Gaza, puts its headquarters in civilian areas as an attempted protection, which is why they attack those areas.
Yeah,
and then they're very sorry that innocent civilians end up getting killed as well, and they blame Hezbollah or Hamas for that.
And that's already been the statements coming out, already talking about how, you know, that language of human shields and that they're underneath the residential buildings and therefore what choice do we have, effectively, is the argument that's been made. But look, Netanyahu gave a speech to the UN. He said himself that he wasn't going to go because obviously there's real tensions between Israel and the UN at the moment, but he said that he had to ultimately go to, in his view, correct the record. He talked about how Israel seeks peace, Israel yearns for peace, apparently. He also said there's quotes like, "I have a message for the tyrants of Tehran, if you strike us, we will strike you. There is no place in Iran that the long arm of Israel cannot reach, and that's true of the entire Middle East," and he referred to the UN as a swamp of anti-Semitic bile. This idea, I think, that Biden has, that the US have, that they're going to be able to get him to agree to a ceasefire on either front line at this point, I mean, it's laughable. Netanyahu's not going to play ball. He is waiting it all out until November. He is stringing it along. And they're basically telling us now that their aim is now to bring the war that they have been waging currently to Lebanon. They're talking in that speech as well about how it's an existential mission for Israel now to defeat Hezbollah, and that they're going to use all of our might, and that they will not stop until the 60,000 Israelis who have left the northern border of Israel are able to return to their homes. How are they going to be able to return? Well, obviously they need to make that safe by clearing the border. So I think we know the direction that this is going. They're not hiding it, and so it's terrifying, it's sad. And look, Beirut is 5,000 years old. It was a Phoenician city, you know. It's like it's desperately sad to see what's happening.
Ro, have you anything you want to add on this?
I just think the rhetoric that is always used, this idea of collateral damage, this idea of human shields, these are excuses we hear all of the time, and it's just so disgusting to hear people use them again and that people are going along with them. And I just think the world at large has been so slow to issue really strong sanctions and to do anything, and I think we're coming up on the first anniversary, and
October 7th outrage that Hamas committed in Israel.
Yeah, but that was also, I mean, we all know that any violence that Israel has issued against Palestine has kind of always had nothing to do, or only has something to do with Palestinians, but the violence that Palestinians have faced has always had everything to do with Israel. Like, it's just so asymmetric, and people are still pretending it's not. But I think a year on from this relentless violence, and the world is still so slow to do anything about it, is just making me feel quite hopeless. So I feel like coming up to a year of this and saying, how much violence are people meant to witness? How much trauma are we meant to excuse and overlook without issuing, like, incredibly strong responses? I just really hope that on the anniversary that we're going to start talking about that more strongly.
Okay, that's something we will do when we get up to that particular time. Let's talk about other things, though. What do you make, on a much lighter note, Rosie? Well, it's important to people probably involved in it, but car parks to be phased out of third level institutions. What do you make of that?
I feel very strongly about this because I have done some teaching in UCD in the past and it's an absolute nightmare. It's a nightmare for staff. It's a nightmare for students. I had to go to class like kind of an hour before my class started to try and find parking, was circling the car park, which means you have less time to prepare for students. It means for staff who are trying to find parking, it's expensive enough anyway. But I had students who were coming up for 10 a.m. lectures from Wexford three times a week. They're exhausted. Like the amount of time, because of the housing crisis, they can't afford to live in Dublin. They can't stay in the city because they have to get buses home for 3 hours. So they're not getting to socialise. And then the result, and then people are saying, oh, well, we need to give them less places to park. That's not a solution. If you want to eliminate, I firmly believe in taking measures to combat climate change and cut down carbon emissions, but you have to have the infrastructure to do that. And I think there are huge issues around housing. There's huge issues around our public transport, which is still appalling. We also have to take into account that people have lives that are not just going from their homes to college. People have to go to part-time jobs. People might be picking up siblings. And people need cars to do that because our public transport is not good enough. And to say, and I mean, UCD has an incredible system for bike parking, and I think 5,000 people travel to campus on bikes every day. So people are doing that. But there are some lifestyles that that is not good enough for, and we need to accommodate that. You have to fix the housing problem and the public transport problem before you address parking.
Indeed, because the caveat in this was where public transport is not available, but they are eliminating the spaces in colleges all over. And I'm just thinking, for example, if you live in Cork City, yeah, you probably could either walk, cycle, or get public transport to the campus in UCC. But lots of people are actually, and you'd know this, Lorcan, travelling from all over County Cork because they can't find accommodation in Cork City. So if you're coming from West Cork or North Cork or East Cork, you're not going to be able to get the public transport, or you're going to need to drive, and then where do you park? And you could say the same probably in cities and towns all over Ireland.
Yeah, I mean, if you take UCD, I suppose, if there's any place in Ireland that is well served by a public transport network, it is going to be UCD, just given that its location, etc. Look,
is it? Because it's very difficult from large parts of Dublin, even for students who live at home. They have to travel quite a distance to get to the route which actually serves UCD.
I went to UCD as a student, and from where I grew up, the routes are still the same, and it took me about an hour and a half to get in. And then if you add in bad weather, there were times where it snowed a little bit and you were talking 2.5 hours to get in. And I had a part-time job, as do many people in college, so I had to get to that. And so it was an absolute nightmare, which is the reason I got a car when I was in college. It was an absolute terror of a car, but I needed it. But I think it is eliminating the idea of, there are also mature students going to college who have kids who they have to pick up. I just think lifestyle-wise, we're not accommodating people.
But there's always there's always going to be an argument that, look, you have to get the infrastructure right. And I do agree with that to a point. But if we're at any stage going to wean ourselves off of cars, if we're deciding that needs to happen, you are also going to have to reduce down the car parking spaces. There's 3,500 car parking spaces within UCD, and it's still impossible to find a parking space because people will still drive.
Yeah, because that's not nearly enough.
No.
The problem is we need more parking spaces, not less.
I went to UCD. No, I didn't drive while I was in college. I've since luckily rectified that situation. But like a lot of my friends did, we lived about a 10-minute walk from campus, and a fair few of them drove a lot of the days to because it might be raining, might be there. So like there is two sides to the issue.
You lived 10 minutes from the campus because that was the time when it was easier to get accommodation. The majority of people now in UCD are either foreign students who do take up accommodation on the campus and who are charged
Which is actually my primary issue here.
Are people who live in the immediate catchment area and can get through easily. But apparently UCD has lost an awful lot of the outer Leinster community that it used to have. People from the Midlands, people from South Leinster who used to see it as the university to go to and who would do what you did and get a house together with a bunch of friends. They just can't get that because it's too expensive.
Which is actually my primary issue with this idea and this piece, and that the university presidents are talking about being more concerned about the students who can't make it, and they're right to be concerned, but they're also the ones who have it some way within their power to help address the accommodation crisis for students as well, in that the amount you have to spend, the fees, I mean, even while I was in college, and they've gone up so much since then, the fees for student accommodation they're just totally unaffordable for the vast, vast majority of people.
Okay, here's a twist from another listener. I cycle to UCD from Firhouse every day and onto my job. It has always been a problem, and not everyone can afford cars. Well, that's true.
Absolutely.
This listener says, build accommodation, student accommodation in the car parks.
But I think we have to look at the quality of life as well, because I think everybody is acknowledging that, particularly for college students now, these are students who went through school during COVID, right, and lost so many social milestones, so many opportunities to gather a lot of social and psychological development. And look, I think Gen Z are absolutely incredible. My students are fab. They need opportunities to socialize. You can't do that if you're getting on a bus that's 3 hours home and you need to be back for a part-time job or to be back at home. If you're traveling that much, you're eliminating the opportunity to hang out and socialize. So I think we're going to have students whose quality of life and their college experiences is hugely diminished because we're just not giving them the ability to get there.
Another listener says, I'm a lecturer. Students are driving to college because it's impossible to get accommodation. Take away the parking and you take away the option of going to university.
Yeah, I know. I think that that's very fair. And I think it goes back to most things that are most discussions actually we have in this country that aren't about housing or actually just have to be about housing. We actually can't discuss anything at all. We can't discuss climate properly. We can't discuss kind of inequality properly. We can't discuss regional development properly because you just can't get a house. You can't get a house anywhere and it's too expensive. So everything is breaking down in the same issue for the last decade. And I mean, we keep calling it an emergency and yet there's not really any emergency actions being taken for it. And it actually is very frustrating because you can't then properly address anything and you can't discuss we should have less cars, but you can't because people can't get a house.
Let's talk about Sally Rooney. Her fourth novel was published this week. Are you a Sally Rooney fan, Ro?
I've assigned extracts of Sally Rooney to my students. I haven't read all of her books, but I find the fervor with which people approach Sally Rooney fascinating, because I think people often call her like the first great millennial novelist, which is a label that she has rejected before. And I think in an interview with The Guardian, she said, what does that mean kind of socially, psychologically? What does that mean as an identity marker? But I think something that does tap into very millennial spirit is that people have been queuing up at midnight on the release of Intermezzo to get it. And the last time I remember people queuing up at midnight was for Harry Potter. So all the people who were 12 years old queuing up for Harry Potter now seem to be in their 30s queuing up for Sally Rooney. But I think she is so fascinating. And that question of a millennial author, what does that mean? I think what really appeals to people about her work is that she taps into this huge technological and social shift that millennials went through and how it affects communication and their image of what a good life is. So this idea of, like, she writes texting incredibly well. She writes so beautifully about the gap between what you want to say to someone and have them say to you and then what is actually said. Like, she's so good on the unspoken. And I think that taps into a very millennial issue of how we communicate, growing up texting, growing up communicating online, and how the communication was eroded. And I think there are issues in her books that are kind of similar. There's a thing in writing that most writers, if they're prolific, they keep circling the big three themes in their work. So if you look at Johnny Cash, it's sorrow, it's redemption, it's death. And if you look at Sally Rooney, you could say it's about the good life, it's about mastery of skill, of emotion, mastery in relationships. And you could say something like Marxism. Or you could take it a little bit lighter and say her big three are like skinny protagonists, complicated holidays in Italy, and simultaneous orgasms. You know, it goes either way. So she taps into a lot of things.
What does she tap into for you, Larkin?
I haven't read any of the books, so I'll read them. I'll come back and I'll tell you the emotions that I felt as I read them. I do think she's a fascinating figure, and I think we tend to judge success in Ireland based on Irish people's success in the US. You know, like how big are they? Have they cracked the US? And therefore we're kind of maybe a little bit insecure in that way. And once they have, we then see them as a big figure. But she absolutely has. And I got two notifications from the New York Times around her book, one being an audio of an interview and one being the interview itself. So like she is a massive and a very, very compelling figure. And in that interview, I thought she had a really, really interesting perspective on her own writing process, on her own writing style, on her own success, where people were kind of asking her, are all your books not a bit similar, those three big themes coming across? And her general approach was, I really don't care. Mm-hmm. You're all obsessed with growth and change and success. I just want to write a good book. If they're all kind of similar, I really like writing that style of book. I might change at some point, I might not. And I enjoy that perspective on it, that it doesn't have to be the next big thing. It doesn't have to be novelty for the sake of novelty. If you're brilliant at one thing, that's better than the vast, vast majority of writers will ever achieve. Just be brilliant at one thing. If you only ever wrote one book that was brilliant, like, success is not like chronological. I mean, you don't need to do the next thing. You can just have one success or two successes and be effective.
And I think I think there are writers of certain generations that become so big in literary circles. So if you think of Jonathan Franzen, if you think of Nusgard, if you think of Ellen Ferrante, and I think what makes them so big and what Sally Rooney, I think, represents to a lot of people is she writes about big ideas and big themes and emotion, but her writing is so clear and fluid and readable that it's accessible as well. And I think that's really the appeal. And I think she absolutely should just milk that. But I think also her relationship with fame is fascinating because she really doesn't do a lot of interviews. She's not interested in being famous. She's interested in writing and doing her work. And any time she uses her platform, she uses it so brilliantly. She's spoken with such solidarity for Palestine. Whenever she is in public, she makes very astute and very solidarity-driven statements, political statements. So I think the way she uses her fame is brilliant and to be admired.
You haven't read any of her. Did you watch Normal People, Lorcan?
I didn't watch Normal People. I think we mentioned earlier on that I went to UCD. I feel kind of morally opposed to reading anything that's based in kind of 20-something. I was knocking around Trinity College. I think I have to stick to my guns there and decide not to do Trinity.
I really enjoyed Normal People. The book, I never watched the TV series, but I enjoyed the book.
I mentioned there's something called the Oprah effect that happened in the 90s and 80s. If Oprah brought up something, sales of it rocket. There is a Sally Rooney effect where the points for English in Trinity have shot up because of Normal People. And I'm just thinking, who are the young people who watch Normal People and said, yeah, they look like they're really having a happy college experience. They're also depressed.
Okay, our competition tonight to go to the Sandymount Hotel, we asked a question in relation to who's death was announced today. Maggie Smith, at the age of 89. Rachel Nulty is our competition winner. I was laughing a little bit that when Tom was talking in the news headlines about the death of Maggie Smith, he mentioned she's well known for Downton Abbey and for Harry Potter, which you've already referenced. But there was an awful lot more, wasn't there, in Maggie Smith's career going back over decades and decades as one of Britain's finest actresses.
Yeah, because she was born in 1934 and she started acting around the age of 20. And I think she was so brilliant because I say this with so much love and respect. She was a bit of a curmudgeon. She didn't want to do interviews. Like Sally Rooney, was kind of interested in the work and said, it was just not a choice. I wasn't going to do anything but acting. And act she did because, I mean, her first debut film was Nowhere to Go in 1958. But if you look at the people she worked with across her career, so you had, of course, she won the Oscar for The Prime of Miss Brodie in 1959, where she was playing a teacher in a 1930s girls' school and had very progressive views. But she was in The VIPs in 1963 with Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton. She was in The Pumpkin Eater, which was written by Harold Pinter. She was in The Honey Pot, which was a murder mystery and had Rex Harrison in it. She, of course, won another Oscar for California Suite in 1978. She, like, on the stage for theatre, she worked with Laurence Olivier in Othello. She won an Evening Standard Award for her portrayal of Virginia Woolf in Edna O'Brien's Virginia. Like, she was just in so many things with so many incredible
actors. But
she was
in Harry Potter. Let's point it down to that.
She was. But I think what was so brilliant was she did these incredible prestige films. Then she would do really fun mainstream films like Sister Act, Hooked, First Wives Club, The Secret Garden. She would do kind of period dramas like A Room for the View. And then, of course, she did become known for Harry Potter. And I think what was interesting is she said after the release of the Harry Potter films, she could still move around in her daily life and no one would come up to her apart from kids, including one who kind of famously asked her, do you actually still turn into a cat? Which I thought was adorable. And then she said Downton Abbey happened and she became famous in America. So very late in her life and career, suddenly was experiencing fame and said, I do not care for it at all. And almost also famously never watched Downton Abbey herself. She said she doesn't like watching herself back, and then it got, and
she probably knew how bad it was.
Well, she said then it had gone on too long that it would have taken too long to catch up, so she never bothered watching herself. But I think it is funny when we have these actors who have these long illustrious careers and we often remember them for one thing. We spoke fairly recently about Shelley Duvall, who sadly died this year as well, and she was so remembered for The Shining, but had done so many beautiful things for children and joyous things. So let's not box Maggie Smith into one thing. What a lovely opportunity to go back and watch her incredible array of films.
Okay, I'm going to move to a different piece to maybe to finish with you, Lorcan, because this is education related as well, from Italy. And it seems that they're bringing back a century-old policy brought in by Benito Mussolini, the fascist, what's called a grades for conduct policy in schools, that badly behaved pupils will be failed if they're aggressive towards the teachers.
Yeah, I think when you start any policy by saying we're bringing back a policy, particularly given who's in government in Italy at the moment, we probably all step back for a second and say, this probably perhaps is not a good idea. But on the face of it, look, effectively what the idea is that there seems to be a big issue in Italy with violence against teachers. Sometimes it's parents on teachers, sometimes it's the pupil on teachers, that there's violence and assaults and verbal assaults on teachers. So the idea being that if you get a bad score on your behaviour, it's the same as failing. So that you can fail the year and have to repeat the year if the teacher says your behaviour, just your conduct, did not hit the level we wanted. There's then a medium grade as well where you have to go to a civics class and you have to pass that test before you move on.
Is that such a bad idea? Even if it came initially from Mussolini.
You're always trying to box me into agreeing with Mussolini, Matt. Every time I come in here, you're saying, did Mussolini not have a point, Lorcan? We can't move on from... On the face of it, the idea doesn't seem too bad. I suppose the issue I imagine with it is that you have to make sure that the teachers aren't being biased in what they're doing, and the teacher having the capacity to kind of, with no objective measure, to be able to say, no, you fail, you repeat. But one of the reasons, actually, which I think is interesting, given the conversations we've been having here, for a lot of the aggro between teachers and students and a lot of the violence and a lot of the verbal assaults has been about mobile phones. Has been about teachers trying to tell them to put away the mobile phones, and apparently that's not happening. I'm sure there are other things around this story, but on the face of it, not the worst idea, but you need some sort of subjective or objective measuring around it.
Mussolini, not every idea was a bad idea. You heard it here first on the Matt Cooper show. I want that on the ads.
He made the trains run on time as well. Very important public transport, you know?
No, I think there are issues with behaviour, and I think a lot of countries have seen a lot of more violence against teachers, which is really concerning. And no supports for teachers or training on what to do in that situation. So teachers are reporting that they're feeling much more vulnerable. But I think these kind of measures have to be so careful, because first of all, you have to be sure, of course, that teachers aren't being biased. You also really have to make space for example, kids with who are neurodivergent or might have ADHD.
Absolutely.
Who might want to move around the classroom. That's not being disruptive or badly behaved.
Absolutely.
But those things can often be penalised. So I also think there needs to be much more training and support for teachers to support students who have alternative needs, because unfortunately those students are more vulnerable and can often get penalised.
Ro McDermott and Lorcan Nine, thank you so much to both of you.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper. Weekdays from 4:30. Today.